Good day, and welcome to the Fuels America Reacts to the EPA's 2014 RVO Conference Call. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Jennifer Mullen. Please go ahead.
Hi, everyone. This is Jennifer Mullen. Thanks for joining the call this morning. We have a number of speakers who are going to talk to you about the EPA announced proposed volumes for 2014 related to renewable fuels. We have Bob Dineen, President of the Renewable Fuels Association, Brent Erickson, Executive Vice President for Bio, Roger Johnson, President of the National Farmers Union, Jeff Lout, who is CEO of POET, and Tom Bias, who is CEO of Growth Energy. And so before we begin, we just want to let folks know that the EPA, as many of you know, put out their numbers today at 2 o'clock. And so our speakers are going to discuss what this means for consumers, how oil companies will benefit, and how the renewable fuel industry will be impacted, both first and second generation fuel. In addition to that, the rural economy impact. So now I'll turn the call over to Bob Dineen with RFA.
Thank you, Jen. I guess we're all just sort of scratching our heads here today, wondering why is this administration telling us to produce less of a clean-burning American fuel? And that's in effect what they are doing by reducing the base RFS from the 14.4 billion gallons required by the statute to, give or take, but about 13 billion gallons, when we can do far more. We are in the midst of harvesting the single largest corn crop in our nation's history, 14 billion bushels. And this would take 500 million bushels of demand away from farmers who planted that historic corn crop on the promise of a growing renewable fuels market, not a artificially constrained one, but every other renewable fuel as well. You're seeing record production of biodiesel today. You're seeing the commercial production of cellulosic ethanol and other advanced biofuels. This is exactly the wrong time to be reducing the required volumes of renewable fuels as opposed to increasing them. Now, EPA is doing this because of a concern about the blend wall. But the blend wall should not be a factor in a waiver decision. And in fact, the minute you introduce blending capacity or blend wall considerations into a decision as to whether or not to waive the program is the minute you take the nation's renewable fuel policy away from the statute and you put it in the hands of the oil companies, who do not want to invest in the infrastructure to allow more than 10% blends to be used. It makes no sense. But boy, my goodness, are the oil companies going to benefit from this. By reducing the amount of ethanol required to be used in this program by 1.4 billion gallons, you are, according to a study that had been done by Louisiana State University, increasing the price of gasoline by about 5.7 cents per gallon. Now, that means Americans are going to be spending $7.6 billion more on gasoline in 2014 if this proposal is finalized. But that's not just where it ends. Refiners will benefit as well by not having to invest in infrastructure, by avoiding costs of the program. And our analysis concludes that oil companies are going to receive a windfall from this proposal of more than $10 billion. Now, last time I checked, the oil companies were doing pretty good on their own. They don't need another artificial $10 billion windfall because EPA decides, oh, no, we're going to reward their bad behavior. We're going to reward their decision not to invest in the infrastructure to allow E85 or to allow E15 to be used by consumers. And, you know, we're going to give them this additional benefit. It simply makes no sense. But I'll turn it over now to Brent Erickson to talk a little bit about the impact that this is going to have on the cellulose and an advanced biofuels industry, because that's going to be significant as well.
Thank you, Bob. For those of you who don't know, BIO is the Biotechnology Industry Organization, and we represent more than 50 companies in the advanced biofuel space. And we're also baffled by EPA's radical change in posture. We felt like Congress formulated the RFS to push past the blend wall, to force refiners past the blend wall, not to codify it. So we think that this rule will create an intolerable amount of uncertainty, and it could undercut investment for the advanced biofuels industry. We've heard multiple times from our members over the past month since the draft rule was leaked to the press that our investors are already nervous. So I see three things that could happen as a result of this proposed rule, unless it's changed. Existing investments in advanced biofuels could be stranded and existing jobs put at risk. And our companies have put billions of dollars in steel on the ground already. Development of new feedstocks and supply chains for advanced biofuels could be slowed or stopped. And the ramp-up of new technologies that are just reaching commercial readiness could be derailed. It appears that EPA is trying to develop a new methodology and taking this radical change in approach, and it creates real uncertainty for investors in advanced biofuels. Investors need to have assurance that the market will make space for advanced biofuels when they're produced. And to date, companies have committed more than $5 billion in private investment for advanced biofuels projects, and there's an additional $2.3 billion in federal and state investment. Industry investments to date have created over 7,600 new permanent jobs and careers, and an additional 7,000 construction jobs have been created. Just to give you an example, Abengoa, one of our member companies, has a project in Huguenin, Kansas, and they've got 1,000 workers on that site today as we speak, and this rule could put that in jeopardy. Advanced biofuels companies are not just commercializing technology and new molecules, they're also trying to build upstream and downstream value chains. So they're working with farmers to plant and harvest new energy crops. Farmers and others aren't going to take risks to plant these crops or collect them if the RFS isn't stable. The rule will undo several years' worth of work to establish these new value chains. It also, people don't realize it, but the RFS is driving innovation beyond biofuels. It's driving innovation in the renewable chemical sector and even in synthetic biology. So it's having an effect all across America and helping us keep our lead in biotech innovation. We understand that the rule came about after the rise in RIN prices, but those RIN prices reflect our industry's ongoing difficulty in accessing the market. And I'm sure others will talk about that, and we can talk about that during the Q&A session as well. And again, EPA seems to want to try to develop what they're calling a durable methodology, but we can't have a durable methodology for setting the annual volumes that starts with asking the oil refiners how much of our product they're willing to accept and blend. That's just a terrible way to begin. So we think this rule is intolerable to the advanced biofuel community, and we'll work hard to see that we can rectify it during the coming comment period. And I'll hand it off now to Roger Johnson.
Thank you, Brent. I'm Roger Johnson, president of the National Farmers Union. Before I took this job about 4.5 years ago, I served for a dozen years as North Dakota Agriculture Commissioner. In a huge part of the effort that I did then, and even before then, and what I do today in my current job, is to try to help develop rural economies. There were times in the past where we literally had dozens and dozens and dozens of new value-added ag startup groups that we were trying to do during much of the 90s, coming out of the very dark days of the 1980s when agriculture was in a deep depression. Of all of those, the vast majority failed. There was one shining star in the bunch, though, and that was biofuels. It was renewable energy. It was all these things around the long-term future, a clean future, in creating economic development that was sustainable. And for us to have gone through that whole period of time and all that economic anguish and anxiety, and then to emerge from that with a really shining new industry, the biofuels industry, was something that made a whole lot of people feel good. And it helped build rural America and continues to help build rural America. Farmers need communities in order to raise families, in order to go to schools, in order to buy their inputs. They need a robust rural economy. That happened in large part in the last decade and a half because of what's happened with biofuels. And I think this message from EPA says we're going to stop all of that. We're in fact going to go backwards because these new numbers actually come in at levels lower than what we're currently producing, both in terms of corn-based ethanol as well as advanced biofuels. And that is a terrible, terrible signal about future development for the ag economy. Interestingly, Bob talked about the record corn crop, the 14 billion bushels that we're going to raise this year. You know what happened in the last year because of this billion bushel corn crop that's coming on board? We've seen corn prices drop roughly in half. They're just barely above $4 a bushel today. Break even for most farmers today is just above $4, $4.5 a bushel. We get one more good crop, and we're going to have farmers deeply struggling to make ends meet because of what's happening in this economy. And what you just see EPA doing is sucking a half a billion bushels of demand out of the corn market. There's one thing that will result from that. It's going to drive those prices even lower and put a whole lot of farmers in very, very difficult economic straits. So this is a proposal that we are deeply, deeply disappointed about. Let me make one final point about how this directly impacts farmers. The result of this is not only going to reduce income for farmers because of the price of corn and other commodities, they're going to follow it going down. It's also going to increase costs for farmers. Those costs that others have talked about with increasing energy costs as a result of moving the biofuels out of the market and pushing more petrol fuels back into the market, that gets reflected on the bottom line on farmers' income statements and balance sheets because now their fuel costs are going to go higher as a result of this. Very likely their fertilizer costs will go higher. Very possible chemical costs will go higher because all of those are significant derivatives of the petroleum industry. So this is something that we are deeply, deeply disappointed with. And let me now turn this over to Jeff Laut, who's the CEO of POET, one of the industry leaders in biofuels. Jeff?
Thank you. Well, echoing some of the things that were, as you just said, you know, POET is also extremely troubled by the latest proposed numbers. I mean, whereas a company that was one of the early pioneers of the corn ethanol business and helped build that to nearly 10% of today's fuel supply, creating the first competitor to gasoline in this country ever in the history of automobiles and liquid fuels, we have also been one of the pioneers to build on top of that the cellulosic proportion as well, which has a vision of several billion gallons. We are building under construction as we speak of a corn stover cellulosic plant, which is co-located next to one of our corn ethanol plants in Emmitsburg, Iowa. That plant is expected to come online in the second quarter of next year. It will produce approximately 20 million gallons, and our plan was to validate that technology, which was all stimulated investment from what was set out in the RFS. We've invested tens and hundreds of millions of dollars along with our partner DSM, which is also evidence of bringing foreign investment, is one of the things that the RFS has done. And now we are shocked, actually, by the numbers that are in the proposal that says not only are we going to slow down the vision and the plan of continuing to create an alternative to gasoline and competition for American consumers, but we're going to maybe retreat from and turn back the numbers. And it is grave concern to us as a company who's invested millions of dollars not only in building corn-based ethanol business but is at the heels of commercializing cellulosic ethanol as well. And it seems like its hand would be handing a complete win to the oil industry. I can tell you that as we begin planning our capital build-out for replication of cellulosic plants in the U.S. here, that one of the biggest concerns we get from lenders and from potential investors are the uncertainty around the RFS2. And today's proposal only will solidify their concern about stable policy and likely will dry up any potential investment, thereby nearly making it impossible to have any type of build-out of a cellulosic industry. And I think the common fallacy that everybody seems to forget is that it's this either-or discussion between corn ethanol and cellulosic. And the fact is, all of the technology that we've developed, all of the infrastructure and the investment that we've made has been made on the foundation of our corn ethanol business. It's been built on the foundation on whether it's expanding technology, whether it's using our resources. They're synergistic. The two plants are. They're co-located. They share energy. They share resources in terms of labor as well as technology. And I can't understand for the life of me why we would even want to begin to take and turn back policy, which was moving this country forward, which was going to be saving consumers money and creating consumer choice for the first time in our history, and now really turning us back potentially decades if we do indeed follow the proposed numbers that were released today. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Growth Energy CEO Tom Bias.
Thanks, Jeff, and as all the speakers have indicated prior to me, I think we're really, really disappointed in the proposed rulemaking. And I would remind everyone it is proposal, and I know all of us on the call today and everyone in the sector will be working hard to show that how they came up with a proposal like this, which I think is not only disappointing, but it goes against the intent of the RFS, how we can prove to them that their rationale was incorrect. You know, we should be moving forward, not backwards. It was just a little over 40 years ago this past month that our nation faced the first OPEC oil embargo. We've seen this movie before. It's kind of like the movie Groundhog Day. We've had economic shock after economic shock based on our addiction to oil and foreign oil, and the renewable fuels industry has certainly helped reduce our dependence on foreign oil, but we still import roughly half the oil we use in this country. We're still beholden to a cartel in a region of the world that doesn't like us, our nation, setting the price of oil. And like any business, you wouldn't put all your eggs in one basket. And for our fuel system, putting all our eggs in the fossil fuel basket has led to a lot of economic shock. It's led to loss of lives of our brave soldiers, maiming our soldiers. And we can do better than this. We need, again, to move forward, not backwards. The risk to the rural economy is tremendous. You know, since the 2008 economic collapse, there's been one sector in the economy that's been brighter than others, and that's been the rural economy. And why, in the time we need to be creating jobs, we want to go backwards and risk that economic calamity again is, I think, questionable to all of us. We can do better than that. We're going to be able, I think, now that the comments are out there, or the proposed rule, to demonstrate that this big fear-mongering that's perpetuated by big oil so they can continue to monopolize our fuel choices as well. And we'll be able to change it. Back to Jen, you.
Thanks, Tom. So now I think we'll turn it over to the operator for a question and answer. Carrie?
Yes, thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, it is star 1 at this time. And we'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions. And our first question comes from Matt Wald with the New York Times.
Thank you, and thanks for holding the call. I was just on a conference call with another organization. I won't name them, but their initials are API. And they raised a particular concern about cellulosic fuels, but it was the opposite concern. What they said was that the, I'm looking for these precise numbers here, but that the mandate was for an amount of production in the millions of millions of gallons, and that the actual production this year was still in the hundreds of thousands of gallons. And leaving aside the question of the overall RFS, that they were still being ordered to use what they called phantom fuels, which have not entered the market in anything like the numbers that the mandate requires. Is that so?
This is Brent Erickson at Bio. I think what we're seeing is that these cellulosic plants are just coming online in 2013 and 2014, and more than 100 million gallons of cellulosic and 300 million gallons of other advanced biofuels capacities being built and brought onto line. So EPA has to project, you know, what will be available next year, and we've made an incredible amount of progress after the slowdown caused by the economic downturn. So I don't know that those are really out of line.
But the amount that they've specified for next year is still an order of magnitude larger than the amount you produced this year. Is that right?
I think, Matt, that's because of the plants that are scheduled to come online next year. What they're looking at is, you know, DuPont has a facility, Abengoa has a facility, Poet has a facility, and those will be coming online next year. So I think they're looking at that. So we're at a nexus, and I think that that demonstrates, well, we're right at this nexus of cellulosic biofuels really becoming viable, and that's why this rule is really troubling, because we don't want to strangle the baby in the cradle.
Okay. Yeah, this is Jeff Law with Poet. You know, what I can, as a company who has a cellulosic plant under construction and is planned to come online in the second quarter of next year, that plant is expected to produce north of 20 million gallons. So you can do the math on a half year's of production. I know that Abengoa, who's publicly announced their startup, I believe is also somewhere in spring or second quarter. And I believe that's to be a 25-million-gallon plant. DuPont also has a 30-million-gallon plant that's slated to come online sometime in the last half of next year. So, you know, the oil industry can continue to use these cute little words like phantom fuel because it seems to ring well to the public and to the media. But the fact is this stuff is coming and is the key reason why they continue to drum up all these little political and PR games, because they're scared of the reality that this industry can do and produce more fuels, giving consumers more choice.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from Mary Claire Jelinek with Associated Press.
Hi. Tom, you said you want to convince EPA that their rationale was incorrect, and beyond just the consequences of this action. Can you tell us exactly how you'll do that? I mean, legally, how is this rationale incorrect?
I think they put heavy emphasis on the impact of higher RIN prices translating to gasoline prices. And I think we all have the data that can dispel that notion. You know, the RIN crisis last summer, there were a lot of folks that were out there from the oil industry and talking about hundreds of billions of dollars in impact. And that's not correct, Mary Claire. And we'll address that in the comments. I also think they're on really shaky ground on the rationale for inadequate, the definition of inadequate domestic supply, and you'll hear that. That's why it's important that this thing get out here as a proposal so that we can make comments and clarify where we think they went wrong. You know, they've got laid out a range of options here, I think there's a number of us that can demonstrate that those ranges were way too low don't live up to the intent of the RFS.
Mary Claire, this is Bob Dineen with the RFA. Let me just add to what Tom was saying with a little bit more specifics in terms of the legal authority here. Under the general waiver provision that EPA is relying upon, there are really two tests. One, you would have to show irreparable economic harm. Well, ethanol is less expensive than gasoline today, 50 or 60 cents below the price of gasoline. There's not a chance on the planet that you could show economic harm by using more ethanol as opposed to less. The second measure by which a waiver could be granted is inadequate domestic supply. Well, we've got more than enough supply. We produced more this year than they are requiring of us next year. And what they're trying to do is to shoehorn into that general waiver provision this notion of the ability to distribute fuel and to meet the requirements. But that was specifically rejected by the United States Congress before the RFS was passed. The House-passed version of the RFS actually had included fuel distribution as a factor for a waiver. The Senate bill did not. And the Senate decided, or the Congress and the conference committee specifically decided to go with the Senate language. Why is that? Because the minute that you allow the oil companies that have control over the fuel distribution system to have that as a waiver condition is the minute that you turn the nation's renewable fuel policy over to the shareholders of ExxonMobil and other oil companies. And that is absolutely not what the RFS was intended to do. The RFS was intended to drive innovation in ethanol production, which it is doing today as the investments that POET and Abengoa and others are doing in terms of production. But it was also intended to drive innovation and choice into renewable fuel marketing, to move biofuels beyond just being a blend component in gasoline. That happens when the price of credits drives the investment in infrastructure. And what EPA is doing with this is taking that mechanism away so that refiners no longer are going to be compelled to put in the infrastructure that would allow for consumer choice. That's the problem with what they're doing.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Tiffany Stecker with Climate Wire.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is again about cellulosic. After the leaked document came out, I called some of the companies and asked if that 23 million number was attainable, and they said yes. And so we see now that EPA lowered it by a few million gallons, and I'm wondering if you think this is to address the blend wall, or is it to reflect a more realistic volume from cellulosic industry?
Well, I guess you're asking us to read EPA's mind, and we're so baffled by them, I think that's hard to do.
As people with an insight in the potential volumes of cellulosic next year.
Well, Tiffany, I think we all would agree that the 17 million gallons of cellulosic ethanol that EPA is now going to be requiring will be easily met. Jeff Ladd, I think, went through in great detail, how they'll be able to demonstrate significantly more than that. You've got companies that are coming online. I think Brent's right. I don't know why they reduced the number from 23 to 17. I think we'd be able to meet the 23. The real question here is, why is EPA sending this kind of a signal to the marketplace right now when companies are on the cusp of commercialization? And this is such a critical time to go to the investment community and say, hey, we've got a program here that's going to drive more renewable fuels into the marketplace, help us get financing for commercialization. And EPA with this is signaling, no, we're actually going to have less volume than would be required. I mean, it is an extraordinarily negative and confounding signal that EPA is sending to the marketplace today?
I would just add to that, Bob, this is Brent, that EPA has been holding up the approval of new cellulosic pathways, and so it's almost like a hindrance that they're creating by their regulatory slowness in approving new pathways.
And we'll take our next question from Edward Felker with Energy Guardian.
Hi, guys. Thanks for doing the call. Tom, you and Bob, you're both taking pretty strong aim at the oil industry here. But really, in the end, this is the EPA and this is the White House making this proposal, and we'll finalize the decision. So why do you think that your arguments, especially the ones you made in the meetings at OMB, in the last couple, 3 weeks, why do you think those aren't being heard and what's going on here? Are they not being honest with us when they say that they support biofuels, or what do you make of it?
Well, this is Bob. I was actually waiting for Tom to maybe take a first crack at it, but I'll tell you this. I do think that the administration has adopted the narrative of the oil companies with respect to the blend wall, that we just can't blend any more than 10% ethanol. And I think that that is just patently inaccurate. The fact of the matter is you can blend more ethanol into gasoline by using more E85. You can certainly blend a lot more ethanol into gasoline if refiners would stop throwing everything that they can at E15, allowing marketers to offer that new fuel to consumers. But you know, I think Tom referenced it earlier, actually. The White House has gotten concerned about rising RIN prices. They seem to have been concerned that that is somehow affecting consumer gasoline prices, when that is just not the case. There's no correlation whatsoever to rising RIN prices, credit prices, and gasoline prices. There are many oil companies that in their quarterly reports have acknowledged that they've made a fair chunk of change selling credits to those companies that didn't plan appropriately. So there are winners and losers among the oil companies. But at the end of the day, I've been fond of saying RINs are free because we have to give them to the oil companies we sell our product to. There is no impact on gasoline prices. And if you allow the RFS to work as it is intended to work, RINs will drive investment in the infrastructure that will allow more E85 to be sold, that might convince a marketer to put in E15. And so you can most certainly get beyond the 10% level that the oil companies are saying is an impenetrable wall. It is not.
If I can jump in, if they come close to this in a final, is this room for you guys yourselves to go into court and challenge their use of the waiver authority?
Well, I think we've got to go through the comment period and see a final rule. But without question, we are going to stand up for the integrity of this program. And if the administration, at the end of the day, has undermined the RFS by introducing factors into a waiver decision that the statute does not allow, I think we would absolutely be pursuing every option.
Thanks.
We'll move now to Dan Licker with Successful Farming Magazine.
Thank you for holding the conference, and that last question was actually mine, and just to clarify as well, could you clarify, Bob, that litigation is one of the options you're considering then if the final rule is essentially the same as the proposed rule?
We do not believe that the blend wall or fuel distribution should be a factor in a waiver discussion. We think the statute is very clear. We think the legislative history on this is very clear. We even think EPA's prior decisions with respect to waiver authority is very clear. And if that is finalized, then yeah, absolutely, the courts would be an option. Again, I want to stress, though, we're a long ways from there, and mm-hmm. and I am ever hopeful that someone at EPA reads the statute between now and a final rulemaking.
This is Roger. Let me add something to this question about whether the Blendwall argument is a legitimate argument in any sense. And I would simply remind everyone that the original statute required 36 billion gallons of biofuels of various sorts to be incorporated into the liquid fuel supply by 2025. It did not contemplate that our growing demand was going to more than double for all these fuels. In other words, if you put that much biofuels into the petroleum market, it by definition will be significantly more than 10%. It would be between 25 and 30% more likely. So nobody should be able to make this Blendwall argument with any credibility, because what it says then is that you can redefine what was originally contemplated. The whole purpose of the RFS was to drive investment in these directions. And so it stretched beyond what the current system was.
That's exactly right. The RFS was never intended to be convenient for the oil companies, never intended to be just what they wanted or thought that they could sell. It was intended to drive change.
Could I just ask a follow-up, and this may be getting way ahead of the process here, but let's suppose that you do have to resort to litigation, and that if your arguments are correct, it sounds like you would succeed. Would that put more political pressure than on the RFS?
I think you said it correctly yourself. You're way ahead of the game.
Yeah.
Look, I mean...
A lot of things can change between now and then, I think, is probably the way I would answer that, Dan. It's
okay.
You know, there's just a lot of things going on, and I don't think any of us want to be saying that we're going to sue until you know, this decision is made. And I think all of us are going to fight like crazy to keep the statute in place, and there for a lot of reasons. Logistically, one of those reasons is that nobody dares go to Congress with any kind of a change, because you don't even, nobody, Congress is so dysfunctional, who knows what you might end up with. But, I mean,
Dan, I just might want to add as well that, you know, the ones that have been going to the courts and litigating over the RFS thus far it's been the oil companies. I mean, they're doing everything that they possibly can, and, you know, to undermine the success of this program. I think at last count they've had five different lawsuits on the RFS. EPA can't sneeze on this program without the oil companies running to the courts. And that has absolutely contributed to the politicization of all of this. We don't want to be in that same position, but you know, we'll wait and see what the final rule looks like. But we're going to stand up for the integrity of the statute.
Okay, thank you very much.
We'll move now to John Siciliano with Clean Energy Report.
Hey, guys. I was wondering if you could explain the ranges. That seems to be the only thing that's sort of different from, with exception to the cellulosic number, it's different from the draft leaked proposal. Are they asking you guys to comment on a range where you would like the blending requirement to be, as opposed to what they've put a definitive number on? I don't understand it. What do you guys make out of this?
Well, we're just ourselves evaluating, you know, what they mean by these ranges. I am actually less concerned about what the actual numbers are, because certainly we will be commenting on what we think is possible and what the right number would be. But I'm frankly more concerned about the justification for a reduction at all, because I believe it needs to be consistent with the statute. And I do not believe that the statute allows a blend wall to be considered. So as important as the numbers are, I want to make sure that the statute is, the rule is faithful to the statute.
Now, this is Brent. I think what's puzzling to us is that the demand for gasoline has been declining for some time. So now why all of a sudden for the 2014 have they placed so much emphasis on the gasoline supply? And I think that's to Bob's point. I don't think Congress intended the gasoline supply to be the driver of the RFS.
Okay. Well, Brent, what do you make out of the ranges? I mean, for Cellulosic and Advanced, it just doesn't – I mean, on the EPA call, the senior officials on the call were saying that they want comment on – they were stressing the ranges more than actual numbers. They didn't even go out. They didn't even disclose the actual numbers, and with the exception of Advance, which came up during a question, and they even put out a different range than was actually in the proposed rule that I'm looking at. I mean, Bob is saying you're going to comment on their justification and lowering, and but if they're trying to get you to comment on the ranges, so they haven't, I mean, they haven't really explained this to you guys yet. They haven't had a stakeholder sort of roll out of the rule, have they? I mean,
no.
Can anyone shed any light on the ranges? I mean,
I mean, we've all just you know, had this for a very, you know, less than an hour, so it's very
okay.
Short amount of time, and we haven't had a detailed briefing by EPA.
When would that occur? In the at the public hearings, or are you going to have separate meetings with them beginning as soon as possible?
I think you'd have to ask EPA.
Okay, so they haven't reached out to you?
Well, I did have a conversation with them today, and I know that we will be talking with them quite soon about all of this. So I do think that the EPA is reaching out to the stakeholders, and now that the proposal is out, is going to try to engage us in more of a conversation than they've been willing to have over the last couple of months while this has been at OMB.
Okay, thanks.
Our next question comes from Ed Meixner with Kiplinger.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is Ed with Kiplinger Agricultural Letter. Part of the question is that it seems that kind of assumption that also when we were hearing from some of the other folks earlier was on a call was that the 13 billion is somehow kind of a maximum. In fact, it's for corn ethanol. Sorry, it's a minimum. Would be, at least under the proposal. Can you give me an idea with the industry now putting out at a rate of about 14 billion nearly gallons now, and certainly going to provide whatever it is, number of millions, 100 million or whatever of cellulosic next year, there's going to be more ethanol in this 13 billion. Oh, and I guess my question is prompted by that the sale of ethanol is determined, I thought, more by the price and supply of gasoline is determined, or largely to that. And so what can you tell me about if, you know, the price of gasoline goes up by the end of next year a lot, you're going to be selling 14 billion easily, not at all? Are you going to be selling 15 billion? Because I know your industry has a capacity for it. I mean, the price of oil is gasoline is high enough. Is the 13 billion become irrelevant in that case? What can you say about that?
Well, I think there's little doubt that we will be selling more than the 13 billion gallons. But what that means is you'll just be building up more and more credits that oil companies then can carry forward. And if, you know, the credits are cheap enough, they'll just use the credits as opposed to investing in the infrastructure that would allow more consumer choice, would allow E85 or E15 to be sold.
And that's why I think you need to look at, you know, the analysis that we've done up that really does point to the windfall that is coming to the oil companies as a result of this rulemaking.
But what about the, you know, the RINs is one thing, but what about just the sale of ethanol? If blenders find it economical to blend more ethanol, they will blend more ethanol, don't they?
Well, they've walked away from favorable economics in the past, which is why the RFS has been so important. They will blend to the point where it's convenient to them, but they will continue to resist blending ethanol in the form of E85 or E15. So if you're truly going to move the marketplace to allow consumers access to more renewable fuels, you know, you can't let the oil companies off the hook on this program.
Can I do one quick follow-up on the E15? I see at least, I think, two or three states up in the north now selling more of it. The states are accommodating it, so stations are providing it. And E85, what's the potential for the upgrades, the up blends in the next in the year ahead? Is it going to be, I mean, in the millions of, or in the hundreds of millions of gallons that'll end up in that niche or not? What somebody have any idea in the year ahead?
I think if the RFS were implemented according to the statute, so refiners were forced to use more renewable fuels, you'd see a lot more E15 being used. The economics are indeed compelling, absolutely, today. But they are walking away from those economics because they really do not want to lose any more of the barrel.
Thanks.
Yeah, I think the really damaging dynamic that is being created by this proposed rule is that it lowers the total requirement, and it lets the oil companies know that if they simply quit investing in infrastructure to allow this stuff into the marketplace, they win.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's totally antithetical to what was proposed and passed into law in the statute. It's just not what was ever contemplated. This whole thing was designed to create pull so that investors would see a reason to keep investing in new technologies because they knew that they'd have access to this marketplace. Now, especially the advanced industry, I mean, they look at producing a fuel product that may not find a home anyplace because the oil companies shut them out. I mean, that's a terribly negative, damaging signal for investors.
You know, the other thing we haven't talked about here is climate change. And, you know, biofuels reduce climate change emissions. The RFS is the only viable climate change law on the books right now. So that's puzzling that the administration wanted to undergo environmental backsliding on climate change.
Yeah.
As a reminder, to ask a question, it is star one at this time. We'll move to Melody Baumgartner with Chemical and Engineering News.
Hi, everybody. My questions have already been answered, so you can move to the next person. Thank you.
As a final reminder, it is star one to ask a question, and we'll pause for just another moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal. And we have no further questions in queue.
Well, I guess this is Bob Dineen. I guess just thank everybody for being on the call today, and each of us, I'm certain, would be more than happy to answer any follow-up questions that any of you might have. Thank you very much.